Welcome to this podcast from Christchurch London. For more information and resources, please go to christchurchlondon.org.
Thank you, Victoria. Good morning, Christchurch London Central Service. How are we today? Marvellous, marvellous. Great to be here. As you are aware, we are on week four of a series of talks based on a quite brilliant book called The Power of a Whisper, written by a leader in the States called Bill Hybels. And the idea behind the series is essentially this, that if God is real and it's possible to have relationship with him, then it stands to reason that we should be able to communicate with him. Prayer should be a two-way street. So how do we cultivate habits that can help us better hear what God has to say to us? That's what today's talk is all about. Now, I think it's worth saying at the outset that I acknowledge there is a huge degree of cynicism around the whole idea that God might speak to us today. Some of you may have seen this quote from the famous atheist Sam Harris. He says this, "The president of the United States, is actually George Bush, has claimed on more than one occasion to be in dialogue with God. If he said he was talking to God through his hairdryer, this would precipitate a national emergency. I fail to see how the addition of a hairdryer makes the claim more ridiculous or offensive." Now, that's a clever quote, I grant, but I have to confess I think it's little more than fancy rhetoric. If I said to you, for example, that my wife speaks to me through a hairdryer, well, it feels like that way sometimes when I'm naughty, but you would equally think that I'm crazy. All that quote, I think, really shows is that people don't speak to each other through hairdryers. That goes for God too. But that doesn't clear up the doubt that many of us have in this area. We're kind of way back at the start of Genesis here. One of the first seeds of doubt that the devil supposedly sows in the minds of Adam and Eve is, did God really say, don't eat from that tree? I'm sure that's a question that many of us have asked. Did God really speak to me right then? So what kind of lifestyle should we live where we can have more confidence in this area, where we can grow in listening to what God has to say to us? That's what I want to look at today. And I'd like to read from the prayer book of the Bible, well-known psalm, may well have been read during worship today, Psalm 46, which I've chosen because it starts with the psalmist speaking, but finishes with God speaking. Interesting. And I want to draw a couple of lessons from it. So if you have a Bible, please turn to Psalm 46. If not, the words will be on the screen behind me. And we're going to read all 11, so let's dive in. It says this. God is our refuge and strength, an ever-present help in trouble. Therefore, we will not fear, though the earth give way and the mountains fall into the heart of the sea, though its waters roar and foam and the mountains quake with their surging. There is a river whose streams make glad the city of God, the holy place where the Most High dwells. God is within her, she will not fall. God will help her at break of day. Nations are in uproar, kingdoms fall. He lifts his voice, the earth melts. The Lord Almighty is with us, the God of Jacob is our fortress. Come and see what the Lord has done, the desolations he has brought on the earth. He makes wars cease to the ends of the earth. He breaks the bow and shatters the spear. He burns the shields with fire. Now here's God speaking. Be still and know that I am God. I will be exalted among the nations. I will be exalted in the earth. The Lord Almighty is with us, the God of Jacob is our fortress. So what kind of life should we be leading where we can kind of hear God speak to us, kind of like the psalmist seems to hear God speak to him in this psalm? Well, I want to make two very simple, very obvious points. And the first is this, be still. Stands to reason that in any relationship, if you want to hear what the other person has to say, first thing you need to do is shut up, be quiet. Well, exactly the same thing works with God. If we really want to hear what he has to say to us, then disciplines like silence, solitude, and prayer are absolutely essential. A few quotes to get us going on this. The first from Mother Teresa. There is no life of prayer without silence. If we really want to pray, we must first learn to listen. For in the silence of the heart, God speaks. If you really want to learn to pray, keep silence. Henry Nouwen, priest, professor, author, put it like this. Without solitude, it is nearly impossible to live a spiritual life. Theologian and writer Francis Schaeffer said this, "It may sound obvious, but it's hard to hear and commune with God when our lives are so filled with noise. It's like trying to have a conversation at a Las Vegas nightclub. We must make ourselves alive to silence to give way to quietness for the sake of our soul." God himself says this to a guy called Job in the Old Testament. Chapter 33, verse 31, he says this, "Be silent and I will speak." If we want to grow in hearing God speak to us, silence, solitude, prayer, really, really important. The danger is, don't know whether you've noticed, those are rather precious commodities in 21st century life. And the challenge with a talk like this, if I spend the next 15 minutes harping on about carving out yet more time to do these things, for many of us that might feel like a burden rather than a blessing. Here's yet another thing in the Christian life I'm supposed to do, but I'm not doing very well. If that is you, I know exactly how you feel. At home, I have 3 children, 5 and under. There is not a lot of silence or solitude in my world. I'm woken up by noise every single morning. Most days, I stagger into our living room somewhere between 5 and 6 o'clock in the morning, and my first words are along the lines of, joy, joy, I think we've been burgled. Oh no, no, it's just Thursday. That's how my life starts every single day. Some of you may have heard of a woman called Susanna Wesley, probably best known for her 2 children, John and Charles, who brought something of a spiritual revival to Great Britain. Well, they were 2 of 9 children, and they didn't grow up in the biggest of homes. But this was a real priority for Susanna Wesley. How did she do it? Well, every single day, she would take her apron and she would put it over her head to signal to the rest of her family, now is time to pray. I don't think this is going to work for me. I actually tried this at home with my own family. My 5-year-old boy saw an opportunity and punched me in the stomach. My 3-year-old girl, Mia, she said, Daddy, what are you doing? I said, I'm trying to talk to Jesus, Mia. She said, Daddy, you look like a fat slug, she said. Needless to say, I didn't get a lot of praying done. Just get the tuft right. Without that, this sermon is nothing. So if you can relate to that or something similar in any way, if there's not much silence or solitude in your world, the writer of Psalm 46 knows exactly how we feel. You see, Psalm 46 is not about cooing doves or green pastures. No, it's about turbulent waters, raging oceans, quaking mountains. How do you find stillness in all of that? Well, many scholars think that the context of Psalm 46 is probably Sennacherib's siege of Jerusalem. You can read about it in 2 Chronicles chapter 32. The story goes like this. Israel is holed up in Jerusalem, being attacked by the Assyrians. They are horribly outnumbered. The Assyrians are so confident of victory, they are mocking the Israelites held captive in Jerusalem. To use a football analogy, this is Barcelona against Yeovil Town, although in the current climate, Barcelona against Arsenal equally works here. It is a non-contest. And with nowhere to go and nothing to do, the Israelites think, we better pray. And so they start to pray, and then something very curious happens. Out of nowhere, the Assyrians retreat and are then defeated. We don't know what happened. Maybe it was an illness in the camp. Maybe they were called to a different battle and were lost. But from the brink of defeat, Israel is saved. That's probably why we have references in verse 6 to kingdoms falling. Verse 9, wars ceasing, spears being shattered. And it's into that context that God says, be still. In fact, the Hebrew words are probably better translated, cease striving. Almost stop fighting. Take a step back. Recognize you cannot win this and trust in God. That's what it means to really be still. The same principles are applied to the Old Testament practice of Sabbath rest. You see, back in the ancient world, it was seen as a very strange thing that Israel would take a day off every single week to not work. None of the other nations did that. They thought it was rather peculiar, because if you work every single day, you get more food. In an agrarian culture, that means you get more money. The whole economy is based on what the soil produces. That means you can have a larger army, stronger military base, then conquer more land. Why take a day off every single week? Well, for the Israelites, here's the reason. It was a way of recognizing, even if we work 24/7, we are still dependent on things beyond our control. The weather, the climate, the rainfall. And so we are going to stop working. We will cease striving every single week because he doesn't. It's all about dependency on God, and prayer works exactly the same way. You know, everybody here, whether you are a person of faith or not, we are all dependent on things beyond our control. Most secure job or financial situation can be rocked by a change in the economy. The most secure relationship can be broken by a moment of foolishness. I remember a few years ago, I was crossing the road with my mum, And for some reason, she was a few steps ahead of me. And out of nowhere, a car came, hit my mum. She went onto the bonnet, hit her head on the windscreen. And I'm there witnessing the whole thing. Tell you what, boy, oh boy, did I pray. Because in that moment, I'm happy as Larry, and suddenly I am reminded I am not in control here. Problem is, most days I think I am. We're back in the Garden of Eden again. Second little bit of doubt the devil puts in Adam and Eve's mind. Did God really say, no, you eat from that tree, you will be like God. You'll be captain of your ship, master of your destiny, ruler of your fate. It's not true, of course, we just think it is. Being still is all about recognizing I need to stop because he doesn't. And silence and solitude may well be important, but it's hard to find that in a city that's being sieged by your enemies. Being still is all about our dependency on God. I learned some of this the hard way back at university. My degree was psychology. My final year project was on rule-breaking behavior. And to simplify it dramatically, I went around my university campus and I put up a whole load of signs saying things like, do not walk on the grass. Then I would hide in like a nearby bush and watch what people did. And then I would come out from the bush, give people a questionnaire, and find the personalities of people who obeyed or disobeyed rules. You can imagine the kind of reputation I received on campus, hiding in bushes, casually coming out, hello, I've just been in the bush watching you. And within a few weeks, I developed a little bit of a problem in that nobody was returning my questionnaires. Probably because I was creepy stalker in the bushman, but I'd given out hundreds and I'd only had about eight back. Now, to be honest with you, I did pray. But my first response was really to work harder, to hide in the bush for longer, to hand out more questionnaires. And if I wasn't working out there, I was working up here, calculating my next move, worrying, fretting, losing sleep. As an aside, isn't it really interesting when we are in danger of losing control, our first response is to work harder to try and get it back, either out there or in here, through fretting and worrying. Very rarely works. And weeks went by, I'd given out hundreds more, and I'd only got one more back. I've got about nine questionnaires now, nowhere near enough to do any decent statistical analysis. I'm therefore faced with failing my project. You fail your project, you fail your entire degree. 3 years of work down the drain. And I remember the day vividly. I went to my room, I closed the door, and boy, did I pray. It's like that moment when I saw my mum hit by a car. It's like, God, I cannot fix this. And I prayed, and I waited, and I waited, and I prayed. And in the midst of it all, I heard a little whisper. It was this reminder of something that was in my university bag. I knew what it was immediately. I pulled it out. It was a questionnaire that somebody else had given me to fill in for their psychology project. And I remember thinking, how can I expect anyone to fill in my questionnaires if I'm not prepared to do the same for them? It felt totally counterintuitive to do something other than my own work I needed to do. But I felt this inner voice say, fill in the questionnaire, hand deliver it, and trust me. So I spent the next hour filling in that questionnaire. I walked across the city of Exeter. I put it through their front door. I walked onto campus, went to my pigeonhole. Only one more questionnaire had been returned. I'm starting to panic. Went to the professor of psychology, knocked on his door, he's not in. So I went to his secretary's office. As I opened the door, she said, oh, I'm glad you're here. I had no idea she knew who I was. She said, you're Andy Tilsley, aren't you? I said, yes, I am. She said, the strangest thing has just happened. We've suddenly started having hundreds and hundreds of envelopes addressed to you arrive from all across the city of Exeter. Do you know anything about it? I said, I might. She said, come and follow me. She said, there were so many, I couldn't fit them in your pigeonhole. I've just been creating more space in the department because there are so many hundreds of them. And she led me to this box that was overflowing with hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of questionnaires. I almost wet myself. My professor of psychology said in decades being a professor at that uni, he had never known so many returned. Now, that might sound like a silly little story, but it's one of the moments that has changed my life. And I have regularly had to learn the lesson that I am not in control here, even if I think I am. And the more I have learned to cease striving, strange thing is I've done less but accomplished more, and I've heard his whispers more. It's just the way it works. 20 years ago, I went on a retreat with a group of people who to this day are probably the group of people who seem to hear the whispers of God more clearly than anyone I've met before or since. Like when they prayed for me, when they talked with me, it was like they knew all the secrets of my heart. It was quite unnerving. And I'd regularly take them aside and say, how have you grown in this gift? Again and again, the answer came back in different ways. Just spend time with Jesus. Now, if you're on the train to work, don't feel guilty about what you did yesterday or anxious about what's coming up today. Just do the journey with Jesus. If you're one of those people that's obsessed with your image and reputation, you're constantly updating your social media profile or obsessing with what you wear or overanalyzing what others say to you, what would happen if you ceased striving in that area and trusted your reputation to God and instead spent that time with Jesus? I have never forgotten their words. And the more I've done it, the more I've learned the practice of ceasing striving. I've done less, accomplished more, heard the whispers of God more clearly and more frequently. It's just the way it works. You know, one other observation about things like silence, solitude, prayer is that often God will bring stuff to the surface of my life that needs dealing with. Back in the ancient world, every 7 years, the Jews would observe a practice called Shemitah, the Sabbath year. The ground would go utterly untouched. It would lie fallow. Don't know whether you've ever seen a fallow field. A couple of pictures coming up on the screen. It's not that they are barren and empty. There's stuff like grass and weeds in the soil that comes to the surface over that year that the farmer then gets rid of, so the soil is even more fruitful in the future. I have found silent solitude prayer kind of does the same with the human heart. The Bible says that one of the roles of the Holy Spirit is to convict us of sin. It's one of the ways he whispers to us. He doesn't shout at us like an angry headmaster. He nudges us to make things right, to live a better kind of life. When Joy and I first got married, we decided we would consult a whole load of people that we respected to get some notes on how to do marriage well, and we'd make copious notes. And I remember one couple, and they told us, one of the things they told us was about a list of rules they had for resolving arguments. Things like, you know, avoid saying things like, you always do this, or you never do that. Try avoid storming out of the room. Try and come to some point of reconciliation before bed. One of their slightly curious rules was during any row they had, they held each other's hand. You should try this during your next row. It totally changes the dynamics of a relationship. Granted, it may not work with your boss tomorrow, you know. If I go into the Christchurch office, Andy, that article you wrote was rubbish. That sermon you preached was ridiculous. Can I hold your hand, Dave, while we talk about this? May just be married couples here. But I remember early on in our marriage, Joy and I had a huge row. I remember it vividly because she was totally in the wrong. And she ended up breaking all our argument rules. I mean, she was horrible. She wouldn't hold my hand. She said, you always do this, you never do that. At the end of this row, she stormed out of one door in a huff. I went through the other door to pray for her forgiveness. And I remember, I've got silence. I got solitude. I'm trying to pray. And there's this inner nagging voice. You didn't handle that so well, did you? You need to make that right. Why are you so stressed anyway? Is there other stuff in your life that you're taking out on your wife? I see I had silence, but stuff's coming to the surface that kind of God was nudging me, whispering to me to deal with. That's just one of the ways he whispers to us. And so often, I will keep my life busy and fill my head with stuff to stop myself attending to what's really going on in here. I find these words from Francis Schaeffer actually quite haunting. He says this, people today are afraid to be alone. This fear is a dominant mark on our society. Many now ceaselessly sit in the cinema, read novels about other people, or watch dramas. Why? Simply to avoid facing their own existence. Many of us can sit in front of the TV and, except on rare occasions, not face our own private life. Entertainment so fills every cranny of our culture, we can easily escape thinking. No one seems to want, and no one can find a place for quiet, because when you are quiet, you have to face reality. But many in the present generation dare not do so, so they fill their lives with entertainment, even if it is only noise. Ouch. You know, I find so many people, me included, we live our lives, metaphorically speaking, like those Israelites in Jerusalem. We build our walls high. We wear our armor. We don our shields to stop anyone getting close. Keep ourselves busy, striving for different things. God brought the Israelites to a point where they had to realize you cannot win living like that. And there is great power in lowering your walls, taking off your armor, and attending to what's really going on in here. You know, one of the things that strikes me about Psalm 46 is it's a we psalm. Actually, all the Psalms are kind of like this. They are public, where the writer or writers are pouring out things like confessions of sin guilt, disappointment, anger, fear. I think there's a lesson there. What would this community look like if we did the same? Wouldn't it be amazing? Wouldn't it be amazing if one of the fruits of this Power of a Whisper series is as we spend time with God, we begin to attend to his nudges to deal with things like our broken relationships, our private lusts, our secret addictions, our inner soul bankruptcy. Can I ask you a few rhetorical questions? What is going on behind the city walls of your life right now? What's your deepest, darkest fear? What do you really think of yourself? Who's the personal people you find it hardest to love or to forgive? What are your nagging questions about life, its meaning, and your future? What are your keenest, unfulfilled longings? Maybe. Through disciplines like silence, solitude, prayer, you'll end up hearing God nudging you to make things right. And you'll end up hearing whispers from God, not through a hairdryer, but in the silence. We want to grow in hearing God's voice. Be still. Cease the striving for whatever you're striving for. And then secondly, and know. Be still and know God. You know, one of the striking things about this particular psalm is, while I guess it is a prayer, the psalmist isn't really talking to God, and he's not really talking to other people. He's kind of talking to himself. God is our refuge. Yeah, he is, isn't he? In other words, Psalm 46 is a meditation. Many of the psalms are like this. The first psalm is like this, where the writer is reminding him or herself of what God has already said and done. You know, the difference between biblical meditation and modern forms of meditation is the modern mindfulness movement that's so popular right now is all about forgetting your troubles, emptying your mind, living in the moment. Biblical meditation is all about filling your mind with what God has already said and done. That's exactly what's happening in this psalm. You see, when the writer talks about mountains quaking, the earth giving way, roaring and foaming waters, that is not just simply pretty picture language. It's not just, oh, here's a bad situation, God's our refuge in that. No, it's a metaphor that probably most people in the ancient world would have got immediately. The writer is describing the undoing of creation. The earth is giving way, waters are replacing it. He's taking us back to Genesis chapter 1 and verse 2. It says this, now the earth was formless and empty. Darkness was over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. Psalm 46 is taking us back here. You see this kind of metaphor come up a number of times in the Old Testament. Job chapter 3 is an example. Job's world has fallen apart. Everything has gone badly wrong, and he prays this. Words are on the screen. Let the day perish in which I was born, and the night that said a man-child is conceived, that very day let there be darkness. Let the curses of that day curse it, those who are adept at awakening Leviathan. In the midst of Job's world going very, very badly, he essentially prays, God, let's just undo the day that I was born, shall we? In fact, let's go further back. Let's undo the night that I was conceived. In fact, let's just go total blank page. Let's go back to the darkness and gloom of Genesis chapter 1 and verse 2. He uses the same word, tohu. Tohu and bohu, the two Hebrew words, they kind of like mean chaos. That's how they saw the origins of the world, this chaotic place. Job prays, we need to find somebody adept at awakening Leviathan, this prehistoric monster. They saw monsters fighting it out amongst each other, powerless gods who couldn't defeat each other. And one of the reasons I think the account of creation in Genesis is partly picture language, it's not all to be taken literally, is because when God says, let there be light in Genesis chapter 1 and verse 3, something's already there. The tohu, the bohu, the chaos, the leviathan, they're already there. And so when God says, let there be light, partly it's God bringing order to the chaos, stability to the instability. It's like that moment when you're scared in bed at night as a kid in the darkness and your parent comes in and turns on the light and you know everything's going to be okay. Now here's the $64 billion question. How did God do that? He did it with a whisper. Just one word from God and all is okay. The writer is reminding himself, even when it seemed like, even if creation itself was being undone, you overcame the chaos with a word. Monsters controlled, creation subdued. Your word's so powerful. If I just look at this, it'll all be okay. Theologian and author Gregory Mobley, who I really like, He says this, and I love this quote because he uses a reference to Lord of the Rings. Get in. He says this, though the Assyrians camp outside our city walls, we will not fear. Though the orcs beat their spears against the ground until the walls of Helm's Deep sway, we will not fear. Yes! If this psalm describes the experience of a people under siege as a reversal of cosmos, a moving backward through creation week till the very pillars of the earth give way and the whole thing begins to sway, the work of day two, then, there is a place, according to Psalm 46, where the deity digs in and takes a stand. Day one will not be undone. There will be mourning the first day, the next day. God will come to Zion's help when morning breaks. Break of day, salvation comes. And there was evening and there was morning the first day. Three times in this psalm we read the word Selah. Literally means stop and think. Fill your minds with what God has already said. Just a word light. And the most traumatic situation, it's like, oh, it's all going to be okay. Dad is here. We're safe here. That's kind of what the writer's getting at. The psalmist really did see words from God are so powerful that you get them into you, they change your life. And we have an advantage over the psalmist. We don't just have things like creation week and God's words there to look back on. We have the whole of this book. And the more you get this book into you, the more you hear God's whispers, just the way it works. And it totally changes your life. And the challenge is, if you don't fill your mind with this book, you'll end up filling your mind with other stuff, and that will shape your life instead. Some of you may have read Malcolm Gladwell's book, Blink. Malcolm Gladwell has actually come to faith in Jesus in the not too distant past. And he describes a whole load of research in this area. And the basic principle is this. There's a whole load of stuff going up here in our minds that we're not really aware of. And what we put up here shapes the way that we live. One experiment where he gave a whole load of people different word puzzles to solve. And one of the word puzzles contained a whole load of words about old people. You know, things like pensioners, Zimmer frames, false teeth, things like that. And then once they're in the word puzzle, they then left. People who were doing the word puzzle with words about old people in, they walked out of the experiment room significantly more slowly than those who hadn't had their word puzzle with old people's names in. The idea is somehow we start thinking about this stuff and it shapes the way that we live. And this has been shown to happen with pictures, with music, with movies, with words. One extraordinary experiment. I don't know how they come up with this stuff. They took participants and they put them in a room on their own, and one of the rooms had a really distinctive smell of some kind of cleaning fluid, lemony disinfectant, something like that. They sat them there for just 15 minutes. Just do whatever you want. They then took each person and sat them in another room and got them to eat a really crumbly biscuit. Crumbs everywhere. People who had been in the room that smelled of a disinfectant, get this. They were 350% more likely to clean up the crumbs than those who hadn't been in the room that smelled of disinfectant. Try putting a closed bottle of bleach under your housemate's pillow tonight. Just see what happens. Now, here's the point. If you and I are susceptible enough that our behavior is shaped by the smell of something in a room, do you think there is at least a teeny tiny chance that our lives and behavior can be shaped by watching endless scenes of sex and violence on TV? Do you think there's at least a tiny possibility that the lyrics of certain songs can cause us to view the opposite sex in a slightly more degraded way? But actually, when we fill our minds with this book, the psalmist believed, it changes your life and makes you into a better person. And you end up hearing God's whispers more. The challenge is for all of us is we end up skimming or not understanding or struggling with the contradictions in it, and we put the book down and we miss out as a result. My daughter is a huge fan of the movie Frozen. This is on in the background of my life the whole time. If you're not aware of Frozen, it's basically a Disney movie written by demons. And The two lead characters are Elsa and Anna. These are two messed up ladies. I mean, they've got some serious baggage in their lives. And I've never watched the whole movie, but like I have these kind of occasional glances and they're friends at the beginning, and then they seem to be falling out. Then one seems to be trying to kill the other one. Then they're trying to reconcile. Then there's another fight. Then there's another attempted murder. Then they're trying to hug and reconcile again. I'm like, sort it out. Let it go. Thank you. I'm here all day. You wouldn't, definitely wouldn't sing it. No, 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 you wouldn't. I can't see who you are. But if you tried the South Service, no. joke. Now, here's the point. I say to my daughter, who's 3 years old, it's a stupid film. I don't like it. Let's find something else. And she's like, no, Daddy, no. You've got to understand the story. Watch the whole thing with me. Exactly the same case with this book. So many people are like, oh, that bit don't make sense. It says this here, but then it says this here. Contradiction, stupid, put it down. They miss out. But when you look deep into the story, it's like, oh, we were once far away from God. Now we're near to God. Oh, contradiction. Oh, Jesus came, changed everything. You work out the story, transforms your life. There's a guy in the States called Dr. Erwin Braverman, very cheery chap. There he is. And he's head of a load of medical students at Yale University. And he was getting concerned that his students were missing important details in their patients' lives, which obviously can be a matter of life and death in the operating theatre. So he had an idea. He took his students to the university museum and he stood them in front of a painting, a little bit like this, for 15 minutes. He said, just pay attention. Work out the story. Look at the expressions on people's faces. What is going on? It's actually a story from the Bible going on here. Just study it. Just 15 minutes of the discipline of paying attention dramatically improved their results in the surgery. That's what paying attention does. That's what we need to do with this book. Because if we don't, we'll just miss some good stuff. There's a tiny detail in Psalm 46 we can easily miss. Verse 4, there is a river whose streams make glad the city of God. Notice the contrast, river, streams, raging oceans, foaming waters. If you know the story, the river is hugely symbolic. Perhaps most famously in the Old Testament, Ezekiel 47, where the psalmist, the prophet Ezekiel, paints a picture with words of a temple coming, a river flowing from the temple in Jerusalem. And it's deeply symbolic of the full and final and lasting peace of Jerusalem. Interestingly, exactly the same context as Psalm 46. And the Jews loved this prophetic picture. And every year during something called the Feast of Tabernacles, they would take these huge urns of water and they'd pour them out in the temple as a symbolic longing of that day coming to pass. Well, in the Gospel of John chapter 7, we're told of this guy called Jesus. And he stands in the temple during the Feast of Tabernacles and he says this, if anyone is thirsty, that peace that you think should come out there, do you want peace in here? Oh, if you are thirsty, come to me and drink. And out of your belly shall flow what? Rivers of living water. Jesus knew exactly what he was doing. During the Feast of Tabernacles, you long for peace out there. You can find it in here, in and through me. And better than that, that's not the last time we read of a river in the Bible. The last time is right at the end, Revelation 22, this glorious picture of heaven. We read of a river as clear as crystal flowing from the throne of God and the Lamb. It's there too. In other words, you come to Jesus now, you can get a taste of the river that gives you a little foretaste of what is to come. And if you have a question, why would God be so loving and allow such suffering and injustice in the world? One of the reasons, one of the answers, just one, there are many more, is the story hasn't finished yet. But we can get a taste now of the not yet through Jesus. There is a river whose streams make glad the city of God, and you can know the river today if you want. Many of you have heard me talk of Blaise Pascal in the past. He's the guy that invented calculus. If you've ever done maths, you won't like Blaise Pascal. Story goes he invented it at 9 years old. He was in trouble with his parents. He got sent to his room and locked in his room with nothing better to do. He invented calculus. His way of getting revenge at the world, I think. Blaise and I wouldn't have been friends. But when he was an adult, he said, one day I'm going to go to my room and I'm going to shut the door and I'm not going to leave until I know the river in here. He said, I'm going to banish everything from my mind apart from loving Jesus and his love for me. And he sat there and he waited and he waited and he prayed and he sat there and he waited. The following day, he writes in his diary these words, 10:30 p.m., fire, fire, fire. Not the God of the philosophers, not the God of the mathematicians, scientists, or theologians, but the God that was alive in Abraham, Moses, and Jacob. Fire, fire, fire. Joy, joy, joy. Fire, joy, fire, joy. Joy, 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 unspeakable joy. And we can know that too. Which brings me back to Samuel Harris, the man that thinks that hearing from God is as stupid as talking to a hairdryer. My response to Sam Harris, for what it's worth, not that he will ever listen to this talk, but my response to him is this, that I am just one of millions of people through history, billions alive today, that through the ancient practices of being still and knowing, have found the river of God in here and heard his whispers. And as he writes his book on spirituality, I would encourage him to do the same, because he can find it too. And there really is no greater thing. Now, a short while ago, Joy and I were having a couple around for dinner. And to be honest, I was a bit tired. All I was thinking was, what are they bringing for dessert? And as they arrived at my house, as they crossed the threshold of our front door, this thought came into my head about the guy. He's given up his dreams of being a leader, and he needs to dream again. Where's that from? Well, we had dinner together. Dessert was pretty mediocre, to be honest. And it got to that point in the evening where you kind of go through the gears a little bit, go a bit deeper. I said, yeah, how are you really doing? This guy poured out 20 minutes of grumble and complaint about everything going on in his life. In the end, I got a bit annoyed. I said, sorry to interrupt. I said, look, when you arrived at my home this evening, this thought came into my head out of nowhere. You've given up your dreams of being a leader and you need to dream again. Does that mean anything to you? It was literally like I had taken a cork out of the emotions in his heart. He started sobbing and sobbing, confessing dreams even his wife didn't know. Just the most bland, innocuous little phrase. It was like I'd got the keys to his heart. We had an amazing evening. Now, is that a whisper? I don't know, but it sure felt like one. Last summer, speaking at a conference, got the privilege of praying with a whole load of people at the end of a conference. Praying with this one guy, and I'm praying a good prayer, really good prayer. And I suddenly had this thought come into my head. I stopped my prayer. I said, look, I'm really sorry to stop my good prayer. But I said, are you leading a church right now? He said, no. I said, are you about to lead a church? He said, no. I said, are you sure? He said, no. I said, look, I'm really sorry. I really think you're about to get asked to lead a church. And I'm to pray for you now to prepare you to say yes when the ask comes. Could I pray that? He said, okay. It got awkward. I prayed a waffly, awkward prayer. We exchanged details, went our separate ways. 3 weeks later, he sent me an email. Andy, guess what? I've just been asked to lead a church, and I've said yes. 3 months' time, I get to go and speak. On the first Sunday, he takes over. What a privilege. I think it came from a whisper. And the funny thing is, the more I'm still and know, the more I pray and study this book, the more I get stories like that. One of my favorite stories, we used to tell this on Alpha the whole time, is about a guy called Graham Cook. He just really loves Jesus. He gets some great stories. He tells one story when he's in a traffic jam on the motorway. And he suddenly hears, rum, 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 looks to his right, big BMW, flash car, guy in a suit, shades. He thinks, what a poser. Well, he suddenly feels God whisper to him about this guy in the car next to him. He felt God speak to him and tells him his name. Now, just to say, I think that's a very rare occurrence. It's happened to me 3 or 4 times in 20 years. And I seriously think God takes great delight in speaking through the ordinary, the mundane, and the humble. And we shouldn't go chasing after hype. Just thought I'd throw that in. But he feels God speak to him about this guy's name. He feels God say that he's about to go to a business meeting and declare himself bankrupt. He feels God say that he should wait another month and everything will be okay. Well, Graham Cook writes all of this down, starts waving at the guy in the BMW. This guy's like, who's this idiot? He says, wind down your window. Bzzz, down comes the window. Graham Cook screws up this message. He throws it through the car window. This guy opens it up. He's like, whoa! Chin drops to the floor. He leans over. He says, how the blank, blankety blank, did you know that? Graham Cook replies with, I think, one of the single greatest answers in Christian history. He leans over and says, hey, well, I'm a Christian and we know these things, he says. Yeah. Well, at this point, the traffic jam eases. Graham Cook drives off. He's like waving. This BMW driver won't have any of it. He drives, meep, 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 pull over. They pull over at a nearby service station. They have a chat. They exchange details. 1 month later, Graham Cook gets a call from the same guy. I'm absolutely solvent. How did you know? What a great moment to talk about the river. What a great moment to talk about Jesus. There is a river whose streams make glad the city of God. You know, if you take anything from this talk, is there is no magic way of growing in hearing God's whispers. This is no fresh revelation. This is no new teaching. It is the old, old ways. It is the ancient paths. It is the well-trodden routes that seekers after God have been doing for thousands of years. Be still and know. Cease striving. Fill your mind with what God has already said. Pray, silence, solitude. Read the book, and the more you do it, the more you hear his whispers. That's just the way it works. Maybe the band want to come up. Can we just all stand for a moment? That'd be okay. We're going to sing a closing song of worship in a moment. But after which I'm going to come back and there's going to be an opportunity for you to get prayer. And I wonder if there's a number of areas where people might want to get prayer today. Firstly, maybe you would call yourself not a Christian, but you recognize you're striving after stuff. And you're like, this Jesus stuff, it sounds like what I'm after. Come, get prayer. We'd love to talk with you about the relationship that's totally changed my life. It's whenever you feel comfortable. For others, you would say, yeah, I am a follower of Jesus, but it feels dry in here. I could do with the river again. We'd love to pray for you for refreshment, for joy that your thirst today is quenched. For others, I wonder whether there are people here and it's like you could just particularly do with hearing from God right now. There's a fork in the road, a decision to make. You're like, I need a whisper. We'd love to pray for you. And for others, I wonder whether there are people here and you just long to grow in this gift. The Old Testament and the New Testament talks about a gift called prophecy. It's a bit dated language, but ancient language. It's a gift where people are particularly able to hear whispers from God. If we're to see God's kingdom come in this city, we need men and women who have that gift. We'd love to lay hands on you and pray for you. The Bible talks about getting gifts from God through the laying on of hands. Don't miss the opportunity. There is a river whose streams make glad the city of God. You can know the river today, and we'd just love to pray with you. Maybe it feels like your world is tumbling down around you, like creation itself is being undone. You can know the river today. But let's start by loving Jesus. It's what it's all about. Let's just, as we sing this, let's just declare how good he is and how we're grateful for what he's done for us. Then I'll come back and we'll get to all the press stuff in a short while.
Thank you for listening. For more information or for further podcasts and downloads, please visit christchurchlondon.org.